Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, October 14th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the weekend's box office numbers and the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film writer and box office analyst Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, let's do it. Let's talk about some box office stuff first. Why don't you kick things off with the top 10 at the box office this past weekend?
Will do. And I'm going to, once I get through the 10, I'm going to highlight a couple of things that fell just outside the top 10, but are still worth talking about. So buckle up real quick, folks. All right. At number one in what I am classifying as the most shocking box office story of the year, if not one of the most shocking in the entire time I've ever observed this stuff, Terrifier 3, the ultra gory unrated slasher sequel, topped the box office. With the actual numbers just came in as of this recording. So it actually came in a little higher than estimates with $18.9 million domestically on just 2,514 screens, which gave it a stellar per screen average north of $7,500. This was just wildly unexpected. We'll go over that in a minute. So, yeah, wild, wild stuff. Number two was The Wild Robot, holding on to the number two spot for another weekend with $13.4 million in its third week, dropping just 29%. Stellar holds for that one. A sequel has already been announced with good reason. Number three, holding on to the number three spot again in its sixth weekend, is Beetlejuice, with another $7.3 million, dropping just 28% from the prior weekend. And here's where things get bad. Joker, Fully Ado, in its second weekend, made just $7 million, which was a little below even what the original estimates had it. It dropped 81%, giving it a lousy $1,700 per screen average on over 4,100 screens. An absolute catastrophe. We'll go over that in a minute, but it is literally one of the worst second weekends ever for a blockbuster film. Number five, a new entry, Piece by Piece, which is the Lego biopic about Pharrell Williams, made $3.8 million in its debut. Kind of so-so. Apparently the movie was pretty cheap. Apparently it only cost somehow like $16 million to make. I don't really know how you make an animated Lego movie that cheaply, but
wow.
Yeah, I don't really know. But I have seen that cited several places. So it's actually probably going to do fine, over the life of the movie VOD and whatnot. But, you know, theatrically it's meh. And number six is Transformers 1, still holding pretty strong despite a really rough opening a few weeks ago, made another $3.6 million, dropping just 32%. However, the broader picture for that movie still is not great, as it has made $112 million worldwide on a $75 million budget. So holds as good as they are only going to help so much. Number seven, we had another relative newcomer with Saturday Night, the Saturday Night Live sort of biopic about the first weekend of Saturday Night Live, which we talked about last week. That expanded wide this weekend, made $3.4 million on about 2,300 screens. So, you know, kind of a so-so debut for a wide rollout. We'll see how that goes. Number eight, My Hero Academia, the movie, You're Next, another anime film in the My Hero Academia franchise, made $3 million on 1,800 screens. So, you know, anime once again showing up in North America. Number nine, I think for like the third or fourth year in a row, The Nightmare Before Christmas is back in the top 10 with $2.3 million, sort of Disney doing the annual re-release of that very popular film. And at number 10, another new one, The Apprentice, which is the Donald Trump biopic that had quite a bit of controversy heading up to its release, made just $1.5 million on over 1,700 screens for a very lousy $908 per screen average. It's probably not going to do much of anything in theaters. And, you know, there's probably a lot to be said there. But a couple of other ones worth highlighting real quick. The Substance, Mubi's body horror film that has just been getting stellar word of mouth, lost another 130 screens this weekend, but it only dropped 19%, so it still made another $1.1 million. It's coming up on $12 million domestic, and this one is becoming a really sneaky horror hit, which is just pretty crazy. And then adding to Lionsgate's woes, White Bird, A Wonder Story, dropped 52% this weekend for just $755,000 in its second weekend. Just to sort of highlight that Lionsgate is truly in the middle of a legendarily bad rut. Okay, so that's where we're at. What do you want to talk about first, man?
I mean, I feel like we should give Terrifier 3 its due, right? Because that's the movie that did this really kind of objectively bonkers thing of having a $2 million budget and riding the intense word of mouth from Terrifier 2, which was this big surprise breakout hit a couple of years ago. And now this movie has come out of the gates really swinging in such a big way that it knocked Joker 2 out, basically. So before we get to Joker 2, I think it just makes some sense to really like give Terrifier 3 its laurels or whatever.
It does. And I agree. I like to lead with positivity. And look, I'm a noted not Terrifier guy. I skipped the Terrifier 3 screening at Fantastic Fest just because I'm not a big like ultra gore guy, like unless it's kind of like silly. Like I like the Hatchet films quite a bit. But look, Damien Leone, the director of the Terrifier franchise, you know, he's been with this from the very beginning. He directed a couple of shorts that featured Art the Clown in them. There's an anthology in 2013 called All Hallows Eve that was a very minor success that sort of was Art the Clown's feature debut. The original Terrifier came out way back in 2016. You know, so, and like you said, Terrifier 2 was kind of this franchise's coming out party, this very unlikely coming out party in 2022, where this $250,000 independently produced sequel to what was at best a cult hit just kind of took Hollywood by storm, and with a 2.5 hour runtime made like almost $16 million worldwide. So, you know, that, so the Terrifier 3 got put on the fast track, and, you know, yeah, it had a much bigger budget, but Cineverse and Bloody Disgusting All In are only in for $5 million. And that includes marketing. And you folks have heard me talk a lot about marketing budgets on this podcast, and they very effectively ran like an online word of mouth driven campaign without any major marketing dollars. And with that, with an unrated film, which I cannot find another instance of an unrated film topping the box office. I can't say for sure that it's ever happened ever since the MPAA rating started, but this is the only instance I've seen of it. And the fact that a movie with almost no marketing budget, you know, did this is utterly insane. It passed the entire global cum of Terrifier 2 in a single weekend. You know, it is already well into profits.
That's so cool. I'm not one of the, you know, like you, I am probably never going to see this movie because the gore thing is not really my bag, but it's just awesome when something like this happens. It's just such a cool story.
It is a feel, and that's what I'm trying to get at. Even if this is not for me, even if these movies are not for you, in a world where people kind of complain about like the Hollywoodisms of things, and it is hard not to feel like good for a guy like Damien, who is also, I've interviewed him, is this incredibly nice guy. And David Howard Thornton, who plays Art the Clown, is like, you would never believe that the guy who plays Art does what, like, he's a very nice guy. And just all involved, you know, sort of like passing up offers from big studios, you know, passing up the chance to do like a less gory Terrifier remake because Hollywood thought, you know, hey, an R-rated version of this thing that seems popular. No, they did it their way. And this happens. I mean, and just to give some context here, this is one of the biggest horror opening weekends of the year. You know, Long Legs, which you talked about earlier this year, made $22.4 million, but that had Nicolas Cage, that had Neon backing it, and even that was shocking. You know, Alien Romulus, $42 million, Quiet Place Day One, $52 million. If you count Beetlejuice, $111 million, but everything else that's come out this year, every other horror movie you can talk about, opened with less than Terrifier 3. You know, it is truly shocking, but it is also truly like cool because it means everyone involved, you know, from Bloody Disgusting to Cineverse to Damien, to they're all going to make a lot more money probably this way. And I guarantee you Damien's phone is ringing off the hook today, you know, from Hollywood studios. And he's probably going to get a lot of money to make Terrifier 4. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, it really is neat. And it is another bit of proof positivity that, yes, the first half of this year was rough, but horror remains the most consistent thing that Hollywood has, and horror hungry audiences will show up if they feel catered to correctly. And clearly the sort of dangerous nature of these movies, you know, with, oh my God, you need to see it to believe it, you know, reports of people walking out of screenings, all that stuff. It works. And let's not forget, this movie has like a 76% approval rating from critics on Rotten Tomatoes and a B cinema score. I mean, a B cinema score for this movie is insane. That's like getting an A+ for an Avengers movie, essentially. It's you know, so it's also not worth talking about some like horrible grindhousey piece of trash. Like, for what it is, people are really embracing it. So, I mean, you know, plus the last thing I'll say without my rambling here, this is a Christmas themed slasher movie. This can now become an annual tradition for people because it has that Christmas angle to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Silent Night, Deadly Night, still to this day, like, that's getting a new 4K release this year. You know, like, so, you know, the long tail of this movie beyond opening weekend, even if it drops like a rock next weekend, like, I would not be surprised if it drops like 70% or something, particularly with Smile 2 coming. It doesn't matter. If it doesn't make another dime, who cares? You know, plus what it's going to make overseas and everything else. I mean, this is just truly, truly insane. And, you know, we'll sort of circle back to this in a roundabout way in a second. But you're right, Ben. This deserves to be highlighted because even if it's not your thing, what a cool story.
Yeah, it's awesome. So Jacob actually had the opportunity to talk with Damian Leone and David Howard Thornton and Chris Jericho, the wrestler, who's also has a small role in this film, apparently. The audio for that conversation was not good enough for us to run it as part of the podcast, but Jacob did like a whole transcription, like a full written Q&A that we've published on Slash Film. So I'm going to put that in the show notes. If people are more interested in the Terrifier movies than you and I are, Ryan, they can click on that and dig in a little bit. And Leone talks a little bit about how he had that opportunity to basically take a trade-off of more money for less control and decided to stick with the control. And that certainly seems like that decision paid off. So congrats to him and everybody else involved with this thing. Okay, so let's talk about Joker now, because this is like the big story, the one that's getting all the headlines, rightfully so, because it's just wild that something like this could happen. Maybe provide a little bit more context or put this in the proper framing for me, Ryan.
Yeah, so look, a lot of people probably stopped paying attention after last weekend because Joker bombed really badly. That D Cinema score, which we talked a lot about, you know, the first movie made $1 billion. This one is going to struggle badly, you know, so it was just nothing but bad press. And, you know, The Wild Robot ended up overtaking it throughout the week, I think by Wednesday, you know, where it already lost the number one spot in the weekdays. So look, everyone knew it was going to be bad. And again, you guys have probably all heard me talk, you know, about, you know, wow, you know, this movie had like a 60% drop. That's not great. This is an almost 82% drop in its second weekend. And once again, the actuals came in lower than the estimates, which is so bad. So let me provide some additional context here for just how bad this is when you really dig into like the grand historical context. Only three movies in history of recorded box office have opened to more than $30 million and dropped more than 80% in their second weekend. And Joker is now suffered the biggest drop of all of those. The other two were the 2009 Friday the 13th remake and 2022's Halloween Ends. Now, the 2009 Friday the 13th remake made a little over $40 million its opening weekend, and it dropped like a rock in its second weekend, but we're talking about a movie with a $19 million budget that made $91.5 million worldwide. It made its money. I just bought a brand new 4K of that movie that cost me a pretty penny. Guarantee you, people are still making money off of that movie. Halloween Ends. Almost identical numbers to the Friday the 13th, 2009, the $40 million opening, $8 million second weekend. But that movie was streaming on Peacock in North America the day it hit theaters. So it had that sort of streaming drop where it's like, okay, yeah, the people that wanted to see it opening weekend, but everyone else just watched it at home. That's not the same for Joker. And also, this movie dropped harder than both of those movies. Every other movie that's had an 80% or more drop in second weekend has been a lower budget thing, has been some small platform release that just didn't catch on, anything like that. No $200 million movies have ever suffered this before. Not Morbius, not the Marvels, not any of these comic book movies you want to cite to me. This is historically terrible. And, you know, there is just no, that's probably why Warner Brothers is being a little quiet. Like they, you know, that you, there's no way to frame this as anything but like absolutely terrible, you know, like, and again, it was bad last weekend, but you know, okay. Was there going to be some curiosity on the part of moviegoers that were like, you know, wow, this is bad or whatever, you know, like Long Legs got, I think, a C+ cinema score, but there was that whole kind of, you need to see it to sort of believe it thing that carried that movie. You kind of wondered if maybe there was going to be some of that here. There was not, resoundingly. This audience is fully rejecting this movie. And to stop my rambling, this is not just a domestic issue. Last week, the one highlight I gave this movie was that it still performed somewhat well in Europe. It dropped 71% overseas over the weekend as well. So it is really, really, really bad. Just to kind of put things into perspective, it has made $165 million worldwide to date, and it has a $200 million budget. I've heard that number as low as 190. Okay, great. You know, that does not account for marketing expenses like Terrifier 3. So part of what allowed Terrifier 3 to dominate is because people assumed Joker was going to hang around for at least a couple of weeks until Smile 2 came around, and they had every reason to assume that. So Hollywood didn't want to risk putting out a movie against Joker that would suffer. And because this movie ate it so badly and people started realizing that Terrifier 3 had a chance to beat it, that almost worked as free press for Terrifier 3 that helped put it on more people's radar.
Yeah.
So, you know, the duality of Terrifier 3 doing what it did this weekend against what happened to Joker is just truly one of the more bizarre full frames of a weekend I can ever recall having seen.
And the fact that they're both clown themed is just like, you know, you couldn't write this stuff, you know, it's just so, it's so yeah. weird.
I said, but even like, cause at the beginning of the year, obviously everyone thought, okay, Terrifier 3, you know, is going to probably be a breakout sequel, relatively speaking, right? You know, because, you know, Terrifier 2 opened at like 805 grand on however many screens it was on, and then it sort of slow rolled its way. So people sort of figured, okay, people caught up with Terrifier 2, whatever. If you on your like 2024 box office bingo card had Terrifier 3 beating Joker in its second weekend, good on you, because I don't believe anybody did. Even a couple of weeks ago, this would have seemed unfathomable.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that Beetlejuice in its sixth weekend made more than Joker in its second. I mean, it just, you know, you can't make this stuff up. And, you know, I don't know. It is, Warner Brothers is really going to have to do some soul searching here, because, I mean, this is, I don't even want to try to imagine. I mean, right now you're looking at this movie is going to be very, very lucky to get to $250 million worldwide. It'll be very lucky to get to $65 million domestically. And again, the original opened $96 million on opening weekend. So your total domestic haul is going to be 2/3 of your opening weekend for the last movie.
Man, that's brutal.
Isn't it? I mean, the more you look at it and the more you talk, it is just truly like, I don't like to be mean to stuff, but it's like, I can't emphasize enough how bad this is. And the one thing I sort of said this to you earlier, and it's worth saying now, is that this is emblematic to me of the pandemic era box office situation, which is, you are either a must-see movie for the most part, or people will go, I can wait to watch it at home. Mm-hmm. That is the situation. You know, Top Gun Maverick, Beetlejuice even to some degree, The Wild Robot, Terrifier 3 right now. You look at these movies that have generated that must-see buzz, they're thriving. What movies didn't? Saturday Night, The Apprentice, you know, these other movies that sort of are like, people might be curious about them, but they're not rushing out to go see them.
Yeah.
Joker is the biggest of big examples of that sort of, you know, but I do think that is still more or less the situation we're in, where, yes, there is some casual movie going still, but it is not what it used to be.
Yeah. So. And we still, of course, like, applaud WB for putting this movie in theater. I mean, well, this movie, it's silly to say that because they thought that they had a big hit on their hands here. But broadly speaking, putting movies in theaters versus making straight to streaming stuff, we talked about how the economics of that don't really make a ton of sense. So
yeah.
They're still going that route. But one thing that you wrote, Ryan, in an article that I think is going to either be on the site right now or going up shortly by the time people listen to this, is that because Smile 2 is coming out and that has pretty good prospects right now, theaters are going to need screens for that movie, and they're going to drop Joker from theaters. And I feel like I've asked you this before, but I don't remember the answer, so forgive me if we're retreading familiar ground here, but do you know what the logistics are of dropping a movie like that, that's supposed to be a big hit from a big studio, and it's just not performing? So like,
yeah. So my understanding is that all of the contracts between like the major studios and the theater chains got sort of renegotiated in the light of the pandemic. And there were all these rules that like, okay, like, you know, a movie has to get, you know, you book it because to play a movie, you will agree to a certain amount of terms. And my understanding is for most of these bigger movies, it is at least a 2-week engagement on X number of screens. After that, depending on performance, that's when the ability to sort of reallocate some screens comes into play.
Okay.
And so I think that that is performance based, if I'm not mistaken, because Warner Brothers almost certainly is going to put this on VOD the second they can, because they got to do something. I mean, I'm still violently opposed to that line of thinking, but in this situation, I mean, what the hell are you going to do? What does it matter? So I believe that, you know, contractually you will see, because right now theaters are probably still more motivated to keep Beetlejuice because that was only on 3,400 screens this weekend, as opposed to the 4,100 that Joker was on. Yeah. Meanwhile, Beetlejuice is still playing. Plus, as the weeks roll on, generally speaking, the theaters will get a slightly bigger cut. So even if you're selling a few less tickets to Beetlejuice, you're going to make more money. You know, so you know, Wild Robot is still playing like gangbusters. So why would you get rid of those screens? Even Transformers on some level, it's like, you know, that's playing on 2,700 screens and it's still holding okay. So yeah, you probably want to keep some for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, so I'm just looking at like what, and you're definitely not going to want to give up screens for Terrifier, because I'm not unconvinced that maybe this does well throughout the week too. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that theater count goes up next weekend, just out of theaters being like, well, let's give it a shot. So, you know, where are those screens coming from otherwise? You know, that's my point. And so I believe contractually they'll probably have the ability to do that, and they're going to, you know, so yeah.
All right. So real quick, cause we still have some news things to get to. Other stuff from the top 10 box office stories that you think is deserving of a little bit more than just a one line summary?
You know, I really think we hit the big ones. Piece by Piece, again, I think it's worth, I had forgotten that movie was even coming out this weekend, which I was like, Jesus, is that a failure on my part of not knowing that? But it was Focus Features release. I guess they probably assumed it would, you know, do maybe what it does in theaters, and then you hope for the best on VOD. It is interesting. I'd be curious to see how they made an entire Lego movie for that price, but you know, that's kind of the situation we're in. And Saturday Night Now, I think, is the other thing you got to look at, is that's probably a thing where Sony was probably hoping that would do better. Now they're kind of going to rely on award season love for that movie to kind of make its hay. So we'll have to kind of keep an eye on that. But that could be a bit of a whiff, because it had about a $30 million budget. So we'll see.
Yeah, some of the awards season folks, the people who pay attention to that kind of stuff a lot closer than I do, that I listen to and follow and read and whatever, were sort of speculating that maybe Saturday Night would need to sort of open big and become like a big, maybe not like a blockbuster sized hit, but like a become like a popular movie that makes a lot of money in order to justify any awards attention that it gets. So the fact that it didn't really light the box office on fire in its small way has me questioning now, if these people are correct, that maybe it won't be able to earn any of the nominations that they were hoping for anyway. So I hope that's not the case, because it seems like, I still have not seen the movie yet, but from our conversation last week, it seems like you and Brad really liked it a lot. So, I like the idea of that movie, even though I haven't seen it yet and can't comment on its quality personally yet, but I hope to see it sometime this week. So anyway, just wanted to mention that.
That's all I got though.
Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and knock out some news items real quick. So first up, Ryan, I just want to mention really quickly that DC has found its John Stewart, the Green Lantern character that I think we were talking about on a recent episode of the podcast. Aaron Pierre, who starred in Rebel Ridge recently, has been cast in that show opposite of Kyle Chandler, who was officially confirmed to be playing the older version of Hal Jordan. So you can go back to the previous episode where we talk a little bit more in detail about that show, but it's called Lanterns. It's going to be on HBO, and it's all about the Green Lantern Corps. It's a DC Studios show that is going to be under the auspices of James Gunn and Peter Safran over there. So Aaron Pierre, great actor. I'm excited to see him in something big, and hopefully he won't get completely sucked into and sort of subsumed into the superhero stuff, and will at least be able to continue to make interesting stuff like Rebel Ridge as often as possible. Okay, Henry Cavill is going to be lending his jawline to another fan favorite geek franchise, Ryan. And you wrote this up for us last week. I think this was on Friday. And why don't you run down the info that we need to know about this story?
Yeah, so Henry Cavill has officially joined the cast of Amazon and MGM's Voltron movie. I mean, this has kind of been in the works for like a decade, you know, like I think it was originally Universal and then, you know, change hands, whatever. But Ross and Marshall Thurber, who directed stuff like Red Notice and Central Intelligence, is directing this movie. But yeah, the big thing is that Cavill is now set to lead the movie alongside a relative newcomer named Daniel Quinn Toy. And I just read a thing on The Wrap today that they were sort of going over Lionsgate's recent woes. And Henry Cavill is due to film that Highlander reboot. But because Chad Stahelski, who is directing that, ended up having to go do a month's worth of reshoots on the Ballerina, the John Wick spinoff. It looks like Voltron is going to film before Highlander. So it actually looks like this is probably going to be his next project. I mean, this is coming together relatively quickly now. So it's kind of kicked Highlander down the road a little further and has moved this up. So, you know, I mean, just kind of, you know, looking at the overall, obviously Henry Cavill was Superman. He was on The Witcher. He has a Warhammer 40,000 thing in development. You know, now he's got this. He's Highlander, kind of a lot of geek-centric stuff, but nothing has really took off as of yet. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this kind of plays out. But
I'm not a huge fan of Ross and Marshall Thurber as a director. You know, Central Intelligence really didn't do anything at all for me. Red Notice, I mean, the stories about that movie and how bad it are, I mean, you can hear tons of people all over, anybody who watched that movie basically, which evidently is a lot of people talk about how terrible that was. So I'm not really thrilled about him directing really any mainstream blockbuster stuff personally. I mean, that's just me. But I'm curious about the Voltron angle for you, because I did not grow up watching Voltron, which is an animated series from the mid-1980s, and was very, I guess, similar to like Power Rangers in terms of like these animal-themed giant robots coming together to form one giant robot who fights other entities or whatever. So did you grow up watching Voltron? Do you care at all about a Voltron movie? Are you invested in this in any way?
This is absolutely not something that is it's just not really my thing. Like, it just doesn't, and again, no disrespect, it's just that I never followed this sort of thing. Like, I was a Power Rangers guy for a very brief moment. There was a ripoff of Power Rangers called Beetleborgs in the 90s that I was a fan of for a minute.
Oh, yeah, Big Bad Beetleborgs.
But that had like a similar, like, you know, giant robot premise, whatever. But again, like, I actually like Central Intelligence quite a bit. And Ross and Marshall Thurber also directed a very good comedy called We're the Millers. But again, I, as far as like him doing blockbuster stuff, I don't know. But I love Henry Cavill, so I mean, we'll see. I'm open to this. Who knows? The potential's there, but yeah, it's not really something that I have a personal attachment to.
I was trying to see, did he direct Skyscraper? The Dwayne
Johnson. I believe he did direct Skyscraper.
Yeah, I really felt like that was kind of a missed opportunity as well. But
I liked Skyscraper, but I don't think it hit the level that maybe it could have. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so the next story is just a real quick one. Ready or Not 2 is happening with Radio Silence, the, I guess, horror collective of Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillett and executive producer Chad Villela? Is that how you pronounce his last name, I think?
Maybe I actually have no idea, and it pains me to say that, but yeah.
Sorry if I mispronounce your name, Chad. I assume he's listening. He's not listening to this. Anyway, so those guys directed the original Ready or Not back in 2019, and Samara Weaving starred in that film. And so those guys and Samara Weaving are coming back for Ready or Not 2, which is just a cool thing, because that movie was like a really kind of a low-key horror hit, just a really fun horror movie that kind of put Radio Silence on, maybe not on the map, but on the map in a bigger way, kind of opened them up to more of a mainstream.
Yeah, that was
audience.
Their breakout hit for sure.
What do you think about this, Ryan? I know you're more of a horror guy than I am. Like, I guess without explicitly spoiling what happens in the first Ready or Not, do you think that there's more story to tell here with the sequel?
It depends where they go with it, but I literally just watched this. My fiance is an enormous horror fan and hadn't seen this, so we watched it the other night, and it was probably my fourth time seeing it. It's a blast. I love the original. Samara Weaving is fantastic in general. But yeah, I mean, I think that like at this point, Radio Silence probably wouldn't have to do this unless like they felt they had a compelling enough idea to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, like they probably have they probably could get another job is what I'm getting at, right? Like if they wanted to do something else. So I again, depending on what they do, these guys are very clever and I've liked pretty much everything they've done. So I believe that they probably have an idea. What happens with Samara Weaving's character at the end of the first movie, there is certainly some questions that need answering, and I'd be curious to see how they answer those questions. Yeah. But yeah, I'm very in, I'm all in on this, and I'm very curious to see what they do with it.
Yeah, I think these guys are slowly entering my, like, I'll see anything they do level of fandom, because I'm, like I said, I'm not like a huge horror person. I certainly dip my toe in now and again, but I've definitely enjoyed everything that I've seen of theirs so far. So I kind of feel like you alluded to this, but like, yeah, the very fact that they're making this, you know, gives me some promise about what they're doing here. So okay, last story that I wanted to mention is Kevin Smith's most controversial movie is free of Weinstein control and the director has big plans. So Kevin Smith, he recently made a small movie called The 430 Movie that we have a review of up on Slash Film. I'll link to that in the show notes. Brad Oman, who comes on this podcast a lot, reviewed it. He's a big Kevin Smith fan. He said it basically feels like a PG-13 version of Mallrats set at a movie theater. So even though the movie is actually technically rated R, I guess. But yeah, that movie is out. It's I'm not sure if it's still in theaters or if it's already gone on VOD.
It's on VOD now. It was a very short theatrical run for that one.
Yeah, super short, very, very small movie. But anyway, Kevin Smith was out there on, you know, sort of making the press rounds for that film and revealed that his 1999 movie Dogma is now no longer being sort of held up in this quagmire of rights that it was in before. So I guess he's officially taking ownership of the movie, right?
Well,
so you wrote this story. So tell me what's going on here.
Yeah. So there, unless more information has come out since I wrote this, I wrote this a couple days ago. Originally this movie was made, you know, under the Weinsteins and it was, supposed, it was, you know, Harvey Weinstein still, and the Weinsteins were still in control of it for a long time, which is why it's been out of print on Blu-ray and DVD for a long time. Like I have a gray market DVD from Korea, I think of it, cause that's the only way that I could really get it. You know, it's not really available on VOD and stuff. Like it's hard to get basically. And so Kevin Smith in an interview with that hashtag show said, the movie has been bought away from the guy that had it for years now. The company that bought it, we met with them a couple months ago and they were like, would you be interested in re-releasing it and touring it like you did with your other movies? I said, 100%. Are you kidding me? Touring a movie that I know people like and it's sentimental and nostalgic will clean up. So the idea is that I think they're looking at the re-release tour sort of next year and they're going to put it back on home video, back in theaters, all that stuff. So my guess is that someone like Arrow might do the Blu-ray because like Arrow did the Mallrats Blu-ray. And so I'm wondering if, but the point being there's no details and he didn't specify who owns it.
Okay.
So I don't know if he bought it back somehow. Well, he did say that there's a company that bought it. So I don't know. It didn't say who that company is. So
okay.
I don't, you know, because he's making it clear that they reached out to him. It's some sort of like, hey, you know, they're playing ball, right? Like they're being cool about it.
Yeah.
So, but then he also, the one intriguing thing he said, you know, maybe at this point, you know, sequels, TV versions in terms of extending the story, something we could never do before. And so he kind of sort of teased that, you know, maybe there's a possibility of revisiting that universe depending on how things go. But, you know, this is one of his more, I think, kind of critically liked movies and definitely, you know, a movie that a lot of people have a lot of fondness for. So there's some viability there, but it will be interesting to see what happens. Cause like Mike Flanagan did this with Hush somewhat recently where that was on Netflix for years and then the rights lapsed and he kind of managed to take control of it. And now they got, you know, this great 4K coming from Shout Factory and, you know, it's going back to theaters, I think next week for a limited engagement and all this stuff. So who knows? Hopefully Dogma can take a similar path cause it's a movie that deserves it. But right now there are a lot of questions which remain unanswered for the time being.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite Kevin Smith movies. I feel like because it's been so difficult to track down that hopefully it'll get sort of a new life or maybe jump up in front of a bunch of people who never really had the proper opportunity to see it before. So I'm excited for maybe a potential small mini resurgence or something for this. I do wonder what you think about the idea of sequels or TV versions, stuff like that. Like, do you think that there's enough meat on the bone there for more? I mean, Kevin Smith specifically said in those comments, he said all the people who worked on it are still viable, talking about like the actors and stuff, because the movie stars, you know, Chris Rock and Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and all these big name people. So I wonder what you think about the idea of extending the lore a little bit with sequels of some kind.
Look, this is something Kevin Smith has done. You know, like he's talked a lot about, you know, Mallrats 2, which he's still trying to make. He's obviously done Clerks 3. He's doing another Jay and Silent Bob movie. This is kind of what he's doing. And he's even talked about making a Tusk sequel. So, who knows? But I do think that Kevin has a way of, people like working with him. So they will work for a lot less than what their usual fee might be. I think my favorite story about Clerks 3 was that Lionsgate made it because they sold so many copies of Jay and Silent Bob Reboot on Blu-ray that they were like, how much does it cost to make Clerks? And he told them the price, and they're like, yeah, absolutely, go do it, because Kevin Smith's fan base is rabid enough where they'll buy enough Blu-rays to justify the cost. Like, forget what it does theatrically. So I guess my point is saying that, like, Kevin works in a way that is friendly to his audience, I guess. So it's conceivable. But again, it all depends on how this all goes. So, we'll see. I think like if the re-release happens and it does well, and like, you know, Arrow does some Blu-ray and it sells out or something, like, then maybe that would be enough to say, okay, if you can do it for a price, you know, whatever. But but I'm curious. We'll see. Cause I agree with you. I think this is one of Kevin's better movies, and I'm happy. I would be happy to see it get the release it deserves. And I do think that it's one of those movies that, like Red State and some of his other movies, that if more people saw it, I think they would sort of view him as slightly differently as a director, maybe more favorably. But
yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailback topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really, really, really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
You're so coy, alluring. Angel with a wicked smile, sleeping 20 hours a day, never lay a paw on dusty clay. I'll keep your litter natural, no chemicals in your nostrils, just corn below, so every time you go, you'll know your shh don't stink.
World's best cat litter for the world's best cat.